Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. A little tardy, some of us, to Chatter on Books. And in just a little bit, from across the pond, we're going to be talking to Jackie Higgins about this book, Sentient, which is pretty incredible, how animals illuminate the wonder of our human senses. And there are so many great stories in this book, and I hope I get to it and we get to it in the show. But at the end of it, she makes a couple comments about what this really means for human beings that I really want to ask her about. But it's fabulous. Claude is doing one of his 18 jobs across the country, so the wonderful Lauren Larson is helping us. We have David Aldridge and I being sad about the gnats, and Jamie McIntyre looking really hip in black and kind of spiky hair without any product. Right from the shower, Jamie?
Just fresh from the shower. I'm fresh and clean.
Okay.
And I'm really bummed about the gnats, too. So.
Yeah, it's not
good. I was so bummed that I had to watch Bull Durham again just to get worship at the Church of Baseball.
You know, one of the greatest scenes in the movie Bull Durham is in a bar called Mitch's on Hillsborough Avenue in Raleigh, where I used to work.
You worked in a bar?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, it was great.
But the Susan Sarandon character was not based on you, right?
No. No, and Bull Durham was a few years after me. I did, however, serve beers to David Thompson once.
How about that?
Yeah, which is
Skywalker. Yeah, one of the few people that I get tongue-tied around because he was such an idol of mine growing up.
And a good person, right?
Yes, had, you know, overcame some stuff and is really trying to help people in his second act of life. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Right, we got to start the show on a little bit of a sad note, and I understand completely why WTOP, which for those of you listening around the world, is the top news radio station here in the DMV, they start the news with the sad death of Olivia Newton-John, which is really sad. Another show, Dave and I will talk about how we both just had huge crushes on her. But also David McCullough.
Yes.
One of the best, one of the most prolific writers. I had the unique opportunity to meet him in a green room once. A lovely, lovely guy. Mm-hmm. Two Pulitzers. He wrote about Truman. He wrote about Teddy Roosevelt. He wrote 1776, about the Brooklyn Bridge, the Panama Canal. It's just stunning. Absolutely stunning. And my favorite book ever, because it was close to Pittsburgh, was The Johnstown Flood. But David, do you have a favorite McCullough book?
I love Truman. It was a great book. I had no idea, and I mean this, I don't mean this pejoratively, I had no idea what a failure Harry Truman was.
Right.
Before he got into politics. Like, I thought he was just, you know, a local politician, worked his way up. But no, he failed at everything. And still became president of the United States. You know, I think it was a remarkable, all of his books were really, really well written. Yeah. I mean, he was just Titanic. He was a Titanic. And he did the voiceover for Seabiscuit.
He was
the narrator for Seabiscuit.
And he and Ken Burns became good pals. And so he narrated some of Ken Burns stuff, and Ken Burns did some stuff for him. Jamie, do you have a favorite? Are you a McCullough fan?
My mind has been racing here while you were talking to decide whether I should try to fake something. Just say, oh yeah, the Johnstown Flood, that was one of my favorites. Or just admit that I actually had never read a David McCullough book.
Wow. You should.
It's embarrassing, but I decided honesty is the best policy.
You should, for so many reasons. First of all, he actually got his start. He's from Pittsburgh. Went to Shadyside Academy, which is the rival of my high school, so we hate that. But then went on to Yale. One of his first jobs was working for Sports Illustrated when it first started. Oh, and then a couple jobs later, he's working at some, you know, publishing something or other here in D.C., wanders into the archives and finds some pictures of the Johnstown, the leftovers of what happened to Johnstown after the flood. Yeah. That got him going on that book. But one of the things I loved is that he became, despite writing book after book after book after book, he was a mentor to a lot of people. Walter Isaacson reveres the ground he walks on because he was so helpful to Walter Isaacson. He's just a class act.
Yeah. I'm about a third of the way through the Wright Brothers book. It's one, like you mentioned, a book that you don't finish on the shelf every week.
Yeah.
That's mine. Like, I desperately want to finish it because it's so interesting so far.
Yeah. And I just love that he could do a Truman. He could do Teddy Roosevelt, but he could, the Brooklyn Bridge. Who would sit down and write incredible book about the Brooklyn Bridge? Just famous. So, Jamie, you got to pick one and go with it, okay?
No,
before the summer.
Right.
Okay. famous authors, Eric Larson, who we had on the show not too long ago to talk about the Splendid and the Vile.
Yes.
Great book about the Churchills during the Blitz. Jamie, were you on for that show or not?
I was not.
Oh, or no, we had
Mark Stern. I forgot it already.
No, we had Mark Stern because Mark likes World War II. Great guy, drank a lot of wine during the show, which made it an exceptional show. And he's written fabulous books. Devil in the White City is now going to be made into a series. And who's involved? Leonardo DiCaprio, Scorsese, and Keanu Reeves playing the lead character.
Wow.
In Devil in the White City.
One of my wife's favorite books, Devil in the White City. She loved that book.
Yeah, and one of my wife's favorite books too. And I only read it because she gave it to me and said, "You're going to love this."
And did you love it?
I got one out of two. I didn't read McCullough, but I did read this one. So got that going for me.
Okay, pop quiz. Speaking of pop quiz, David might get this because of something we were talking about while we were waiting for Jamie to join the show. Who was the first female? This is good. This will be a good segue to our featured author, Jackie Higgins, who's on the top of our screen now. Who was the first female in England to author a book in English and under her own name? And I'll give you three choices. And let's see, because David showed up on time, he gets to guess first. Jane Austen, who wrote in the 18th century, and technically she wrote under a lady. She didn't really use a name, so we'll give her that. Catherine Parr, sixth wife of Henry VIII, or Marjorie Kemp, who wrote The Book of Marjorie Kemp in 1438, a really creative title, which is she dictated essentially her life story to a scribe.
Why would you think I would get that?
I think the answer is
something we were talking about earlier, David. You'll get it.
The answer is inherent in the question, I think, but I'll let Dave go first.
Oh, God, I'm going to be wrong. I think Catherine Parr, but I don't know. Wrong.
A detail that I didn't include. Marjorie Kemp, who wrote the book of Marjorie Kemp in 1438, story of her life dictated to a scribe and is widely seen as the first autobiography in English. The mother of 14 children, Kemp became a chaste pilgrim after experiencing religious visions. I too would have visions if I had 14 children. Okay, Jamie, do you have a guess?
Well, it's obviously her. I mean, the 1400s, I mean,
okay.
How could it be any other? That's why I said I thought the answer was inherent in the question, but tell me if I'm wrong.
Okay, well, it's kind of a trick answer, and it could be wrong, but I did try to check this out on multiple sources online. Catherine Parr seems to get, the nod as the first female to have a book published in English with her name as the author. Now, hold on. It was called Prayers or Meditations. And it was mostly a translation of a book published earlier in Latin by a pro-Catholic bishop. So technically, did she really write or did she translate it? But David, we were talking about seeing the musical Six earlier.
Oh, and yes. That's right. You're
wonderful.
Right.
That's and correct. Everyone should go to see that if they have a chance. It's great. It's wonderful about the six wives of Henry VIII. And it's like rap, cabaret. It's great. So that's what I thought. Okay. But I think nobody wins. Okay.
I would say nobody wins this week. I agree.
Nobody wins. Okay. We've got to do 1 minute on this before we go to our wonderful author, Jackie Higgins, because it's such a great story. And this was in the New York Times back in July, which is how long I've been trying to get this on the show. And this is by Jennifer Zelai. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Math defeated him in school. In his 60s, he went back for more. This incredible guy, Alec Wilkinson, I want to meet this guy, done a lot of things. And he's got a book called In a Divine Language. And he admitted that he only passed high school math because he cheated. Mm-hmm. And he decided in his 60s he was going to go back and try to do math. And among other things, he enlisted his niece, who's a PhD somewhere in something like Northwestern, teaching math or something like that. And at a certain point, it became so painful for her that she refused to take his phone calls. But it's this great book. And what's wonderful about it is it's not about math, which I hate, and I break out in hives when I think about it. But it just opened his eyes to new ways of seeing things, to new ways of thinking about things. Right. So it's a wonderful book for anybody who's listening. It's a wonderful book. I encourage you to get it. David, if you had to go back to high school or college and redo a subject, what would it be?
Oh, gosh. You know, it's funny because I did fine in college. I can't think of a single class I would take again because I didn't like the grade.
What was your GPA?
3.46, something like that. But But ironically, the class that humbled me more than anything was high school calculus in the 12th grade.
Why is that ironic?
Well, because I loved math, and it's ironic because we're talking about somebody who went back and took math. And I loved math. I was great in geometry, trigonometry, and everything, and calculus kicked my butt. Oh, my God. It was embarrassing how bad I was at calculus. Couldn't figure it out at all. It was literally another language.
Interesting. About 20 years out of high school, college, or whatever, I'm driving somewhere with my dad, maybe the Beltway. And long story short, as I'm, you know, negotiating, trying to exit the Beltway or get on the Beltway or whatever kind of stuff, he says, you know, your brain's doing calculus right now. It's looking at the variety of factors and guessing that at this rate and this speed and this, these kinds of things are happening.
Yeah.
And I said, where the F were you when I was in high school? Because it didn't kind of make sense. Jamie, any class you would redo?
So I actually did try to redo it. So first of all, just to be completely honest, I didn't graduate high school on time because I flunked English and government in my senior year. But I managed to go on.
For a journalist who has worked in Washington, D.C.
I still had a good college career at the University of Florida. But I minored in French, but I never used my French. So I forgot it all over the years. So the class I wanted to go back and do again was French. And I actually did. My daughter took French in college at Montgomery College. I signed up for the same class and figured I would go there and all the French would come flowing back to me and it would be wonderful. But I discovered that at my advanced age at the time, it did not all come back. And, you know, like language and music. And I think sometimes math, once we get older, we don't have enough new synapses to open up in our brains to do that. So I've had to struggle to the rest of my life without having a working knowledge of French other than the dialogues we memorized in high school.
Nice. Among my many disasters in college was organic chemistry, which I got a C the first time I took it. I may have told the show this story. I got a C and I thought, you know, I didn't study. I partied too much. I'll work hard. I'll study and I'll get a tutor. And I got a D. So that's when I moved on from my pre-vet career. All right. Our author is here, Jackie Higgins, and she's across
the spot. For some reason, she's stuck around. I don't know why.
Very late. Jackie Higgins, well,
you want to hear that exciting
I'm trying to understand these college conversations. It's very different from my experience back in Britain.
Yeah, very different, Jackie, because thank you so much for joining us. Among other, this is our 2 weeks
in
Oxford grad, which is really intimidating. Was there anything you didn't like or you didn't do well when you were at Oxford?
Well, it's different. So I just did zoology. I mean, I did a course in invertebrates and vertebrates, evolution, animal behavior, but it's much more specialized. We don't have such a kind of liberal expansion of subjects. So quite quickly in England, you begin to narrow. I've got kids who are already narrowing. You know, A-levels, which are the exams you take before you go to university. There's only three subjects you choose. And then at university, you do one or two subjects. So generally one.
It sounds like from what I know, a little bit of what I've read and some of the interviews I've listened to with you, you're from Cornwall, right?
Yes.
Beautiful beaches, just beautiful areas, incredible terrain. And I imagine you as a small child scurrying around on the beaches, picking up all sorts of creatures and examining them. Is that where the love of all of this zoology came from?
Yes, probably. Also, my mother was a biology teacher. So I spent many happy hours on the beach poking around in rock pools. Essentially, I've never grown up. I am that kid aged 3 or 4 or 5 who's always turning over a rock, always prodding, always wondering whether that's going to sting me.
Sometimes.
I think it's that you, it's I think what zoology for me is the ability to ask that question, why? Why is the world the way it is? And that's a real, that is a kid's question. It's kind of childlike curiosity that thankfully hasn't dimmed.
It's a great question. I said before you joined us at the start of the show, I've got, you know, I always say to people, make sure you read all the way through a book and then always read the acknowledgements, read the, you know, the preface. And you said some things at the end of this book, Sentient, that I want to ask you about. But you, so much of your career is visual. You're a photographer. You make films,
yes.
BBC, Discovery, National Geographic. What caused you to turn to the written word, or who caused you to turn to the written word?
I think it was I've always loved the written word. I wish, so here's an admission. I gave up studying English literature at school, which I'm so embarrassed about. I think consequently I've read to make up for that. And my daughter actually is just applying to university to do English lit. So I've always had a fascination with the, I read a lot. I've always had a fascination with the spoken word and how to tell a story. I don't think I'm a particularly good with words, but I think I can tell a story. And that's something that I learnt when I was crafting documentaries. And to a certain extent, I wonder, did you think the book was at all visual when you were reading it? Because I wonder whether I'm still seeing the story unspool visually in my head. Yeah. And that's what I'm writing.
Yeah, as David and Jamie know, I'm just a very visual person. And yes, I could see the pictures and I could see the star-nosed mole and I could, picture in my mind.
Oh, I think it would make a superb, I suppose, really what I was doing for a couple of years, I worked on the BBC development team, the science development team. Uh-huh. There were a bunch of us whose job it was to kind of pluck out the new series ideas that the BBC would invest in. And I think this would make, I mean, I think that's what I was doing, really. I was working in a development office, coming up with a good series to be on the box.
How did you find writing versus producing things for the screen?
I mean, it's a much more solitary existence. Uh-huh. Television is very much about teamwork. You know, you're working with a camera person, an editor, lots of minds come together with television. Uh-huh. So it's very solitary. But I think that the conversations that I was having with scientists, the stories that I was researching, the way that the story kind of, the elements of the story came together was very much like being in an edit suite. And as I was writing, to begin with, you kind of think you know you're making sense, but actually when you read it back, it's too waffly. There's too many ideas in there, all of which are valid and could take you off on a different spin. But when you're writing for television, you have to be really simple and chase that idea. And I think that happened in the book. So it was almost like being in an edit suite. The story just got more and more fluid and compressed and directed.
Great.
And that's not dumbing down. In fact, if anything, it's really getting to the grips with the kind of nuts and bolts of what made me interested about that subject.
Oh, yeah. David?
The book was wonderful. And it was wonderful because it was all new information, because we just know so little about everything, really. But I was fascinated. I was fascinated by two things. One, the stat that 99.9% of all the available space on Earth is down at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. Like, that blew my mind when the guy said we could put Mount Everest into this trench. You know, like, what?
Yeah. And again, so visual. Yeah, that blew my mind. I mean, these are facts that I'm learning as a television documentary maker. These are facts that I'm learning as I'm speaking to the scientists who I rely on, whose stories and knowledge I've relied on to create this story. But that blew my mind. The facts that blew my mind, I hope are in the book.
I have to ask you, I told Tori, I have to ask you about Tyson, the punching mantis shrimp. Yes. This is phenomenal. This is awesome.
Only because the name was so phenomenal.
It's a shrimp that knocks other creatures out and eats them. That is so great.
That was your story. Of course it's your story. I know, what a character. And it's quite funny. My husband, when I studied zoology and he and I were dating when we were at Oxford, he would always say, he'd always put, making fun of my subject, put two animals in the boxing ring. Who would win between? And here we have the absolute winner with Tyson.
That's such a guy sports thing.
I know. Infuriating. No, I do study serious things. I'm studying, you know, evolution and algorithm. No, I do.
Anyway. But tell us about Tyson and what his unique abilities are and what that translates in terms of meaning for us.
Well, so everyone loves Tyson for his punch and everyone knows Tyson for his punch, but his eyes are extraordinary. And when one of the scientists started looking at his eyes and the photoreceptors, so photoreceptors are simply the light sensors in our eye. Justin Marshall was looking at the light sensors in Tyson's eye, not Tyson specifically, but another Tyson, and found very many more different kinds of color light sensor that are in our eye. We typically have three. We can see a rainbow in many colors with these three photosensors. But Tyson has many more, as many as 12. and that's just for color. And then he's got all sorts of other strange abilities. He's able to see polarized light. He's the only species, or it is the only species, able to see circularly polarized light. So it extracts information from the sun's light rays that just bypass us. In fact, every other species on the planet is blind to, so far as we know, blind to that particular quality of light. So I used Tyson and the Harlequin mantis shrimp as a way of understanding how we see color. So this was the kind of the conversation throughout the book, was how animals enable us to better understand what it means to be human.
Yeah. I found myself, to Dave's point, I found myself for the last few weeks reading the book, listening to the book. Great narration, by the way. I forget the name.
In the States, have you got the English narration or have you got an American narrator?
No, the English narration. And God bless her, because some of the Latin names, just her ability to spit those out was great. But I found, with the last couple of weeks, I've been driving my friends and family crazy. It's like, oh my God, let me tell you this thing about barn owls that you never knew. And let me Tyson. I've been talking about Tyson for weeks now. But it's brilliant. So thing. So the owls and their hearing, and they don't really have ears like we do, but their hearing is phenomenal. And I feel like, I always like to think that I know a fair amount about animals and birds, whatever, but I had no idea that owls could, for instance, find prey under feet of snow. Because
they do the great gray owl. But no, it's extraordinary. We look at the I don't know if you can hear that, that's my cat howling outside at the neighbor's cat. We look at owls and you see their eyes. We're bewitched by these bright yellow eyes and we immediately think of their sight, and they do have exceptional sight. But that particular owl that I focus on does these extraordinary snow plunges. So the great gray owl, I don't know if any of you have lived far enough north in the northern forests where this creature lives, but it's got a vast wingspan and it can swoop on a mound of virgin snow. So there are no other sensory signals that it's picking up on. It's not picking up on body heat because that would be diminished by the blanket of cold on top of it. It's not using visual signals. It's using sound. And the key is it's using two ears. So I talk of stereo hearing, essentially, and how that almost maps into sight, making it uses its ears like we use eyes.
Absolutely remarkable.
So you know how they say there's no such thing as a stupid question? Well, I'm going to test
I'm
that.
I'm sure that's not the case. Right, you're about to foil me here.
When I was a child growing up, I was told, and I have no idea if this is true, that dogs and cats saw in black and white and we saw in color as humans. I have no idea whether that was true or not. So first you could disabuse me of that. But the bigger question, I always wondered this when people would tell me that animals saw things differently than us, is how do we know what they see? How can we, if we can't plug into them and get a readout from their brain about what it looks like to them, how do we know?
So there, you've asked one of the cleverest questions, masqueraded as a dumb question. So this is a question that scientists are very reluctant to answer. But the way that we go about answering it, and the way I did in the book, is you look at the hardware. You look at how many photoreceptors that shrimp has. You look at how the nerves are kind of feeding back to the brain. So you look at the hardware, the physiology of the animal, and then you make an assumption. And that's originally what the scientists, they made an assumption about Tyson. They, people have been kind of waving their arms around in the air, scientists waving their arms around in the air, saying they must see a thermonuclear bomb of explosion. I mean, a world of kind of hypnotic rainbows and way beyond anything that we could sense. But the funny thing is that when Justin Marshall asked one of his students to test, and so this lady very patiently kind of trained shrimps trained it to recognize colors in exchange for a piece of delicious shrimp meat or a snail. And what they found was that actually the shrimp has far less good color sight than us. So it's a wonderful kind of philosophical question, essentially, wondering what other creatures can see. And although we can understand the technology and the hardware of what these animals have, it takes a leap of faith and a leap of imagination to wonder what their perception is. We're back to that famous paper by Thomas Nagel, written in the 1970s, about what it's like to be a bat. And he comes up with the same conclusion. So we all, you know, scientists can tell us as much information about how these bats are essentially perceiving the world. They grasp, they apprehend the world through sound. And because we're such visual creatures, we translate that into images. But that's because if we're locked in our bodies with our own subjective kind of conscious experience, it's impossible to know what you're thinking, let alone what Tyson's thinking or a bat's thinking or your dog or your cat.
Okay, that is a great segue to this wonderful book, Sentient, is about the animals. It's about what we can learn about ourselves, but it's also about the people who study them. The person who devotes months and years to training shrimp, to the people who want to watch the bats for months and months and months. There's a great story in there about people watching bats to see what they did, and it was terrifying. They run out screaming. But talk about some of the people that you met doing this. And I thought the way you brought their interviews to life was fabulous.
Well, these are the heroes on whom the stories stand. I mean, it's these people's stories that enable us to really understand what is going on. Their patience, their rigor, their curiosity. I mean, I've spoken to all sorts of extraordinary people. Ken Catania, who's quite well known over in the States for studying the star-nosed mole. He's made the star-nosed mole and very many intriguing organisms his subject of speciality. And these people intrigue me as well. I mean, part of the way that I was taught when I was making wildlife films to get a handle on science and tell stories is using the story of the people who are studying these creatures, their journey of discovery, hook someone in, and you begin to understand the painstaking efforts that have gone into, I don't know, counting the number of touch sensors on the end of that tiny star. Mm-hmm. You know, Ken Catania proved that in a star, you've seen these little creatures, they're bewitching. They fit in the palm of my hand. They've got a little star for a nose, which is about the same size as my little finger, but they managed to squeeze 5 times the sensitivity of the palm of my hand into that little finger. So he counted every single mechanoreceptor. I mean, it took him a long time.
That was one of my favorite chapters. I think it was chapter 4, the star-nosed mole. You get in one chapter and it all made sense. It was all connected. Helen Keller, the star-nosed mole, the painter who was blind, but he saw by feeling. So what was the process writing a chapter like that? Did it come to you organically? Or
I do a deep dive and I look for the stories that intrigue me and I stitch them together. And I think that one of the nicest compliments I got on the catfish chapter, Linda Bartoshock is incredibly well known because she discovered that there are super tasters and super tasters simply by tasting the taste buds on your tongue. And I think her story's been told a couple of times before, but so she was like, well, are we really going to tell it again? I said, go on, trust me. I think this is going to be fun. We're going to interweave you with the catfish. And she loved it. She'd never heard that story told, woven with this creature. Catfish essentially have their taste buds on their skin. So they're essentially swimming tongues. And I chose this Goliath catfish that swims through the soupy Amazonian black waters. When I come to a subject, it's about the stories that grab my attention, but they have to kind of knit together and reflect off one another and prove a bigger point.
I drove several people crazy with the story about the Goliath catfish. And I said, no, because I said, they found a monkey in a Goliath catfish. I said, I'm sure there are catfish out there with body parts in them or whatever.
That was great. I didn't know about that story of Theodore Roosevelt and his fabulous, explorations of the Rio Dadu. I'm not going to say it right. One tributary of the Amazon.
All right. One of my other favorite stories was, I would call it the reciprocity of vampire bats. And where the ones that come back, can you tell that story about the ones that come back having had a good meal, blood, help out the other ones who haven't eaten, but they're helping them out by grooming them?
Yeah, so this is part of my story with regards to touch. And not just the Starnes-Moll aspect of touch, which is feeling the topography of the world, the shape, the smoothness, the texture. It's about how touch makes us feel and what we'll do for touch. And the vampire bat, much maligned as a creature, I wanted to basically redress this because I knew about this study for a long time. It's famous in evolutionary biology. In fact, when Richard Dawkins, who was my tutor at Oxford, when he'd written The Selfish Gene, he then rewrote an aspect of it to include this story about vampire bats, because what they do is they go out to hunt. Apparently, when they come back from the hunt, it's very easy to, speaking to the scientists, to recognize which ones have eaten. I mean, they're balloons. Yeah. They're little balloons of blood. But some of them don't eat. And when they don't eat, they are so that the metabolism's working so high, and blood's not a doesn't last as a food source, and so they can starve. And so the colony of bats looks after one another. So if a bat hasn't eaten, it will groom a bat who's nice and bulbous and blood full. It will groom that bat, and that bat will regurgitate some of its ill-gotten gains to make sure that. To make sure that the colony survives. So this was a wonderful, there's all sorts. One of the interesting aspects of evolutionary biology, you look into, you know, being taught by the man who wrote The Selfish Gene, you talk about, you know, how does altruism exist in this world? If we're all run by selfish genes, how do you find altruistic acts? And so the vampire bat is a very good example of that. It's an example of tit for tat. Scratch my back and I'll regurgitate blood in yours.
Yeah. One of the most wonderful things about this book, Sentience Again, it's about these people, it's about these incredible animals, but then they're, Jackie, you always bring it to what does that mean for us and what are the questions we should be asking about ourselves? Talk a little bit about touch. And I think we've talked about this on the show, Dave and Jamie, about how we increasingly are in a touchless society. And the pandemic really, you know, amplified that. I mean, so much technology, so much online. Flippin' Mark Zuckerberg wants us all living in a metaverse or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, people are buying real estate in the metaverse. People are buying real estate in the metaverse, which I hate.
We've gone mad.
Yeah, you talk a little bit in the book about the importance of touch, and it's not just animals, but it's also humans. Can you talk about that a little bit?
There are two chapters on touch I talked about. So we all know this touch, in our the senses in our fingers. We've got very many different senses that enable us to feel the roughness, smoothness, the shape. But what scientists are beginning to discover that in the rest of our skin are other neurons that respond to other touches. And I found it staggering that our skin wasn't that well understood. I mean, I've likened it to looking up at the cosmos. We could look to our skin. There's still not very much understood about what's going on in there that makes us feel. And this is the other aspect to touch, how we feel when we are touched. And Francis McGlone, who was one of the main scientists whose work I relied on in that chapter, is fascinating about this. I ended up writing a few pieces for British papers over here during COVID because he warns, he's one of the scientists, there's a whole team of scientists who've been studying this neuron I was just telling you about. I mean, it was only really, it's only being understood now. It was recognised a couple of decades ago, but the work now is only being, it's relatively recent to understand what makes it fire. And it's very simple. It's a slow movement across skin, with a light pressure, and it fires when the person or the thing touching you is body temperature. It's a caress.
Mm-hmm.
So once that's fired, you know, we've got to understand it. It activates a different part of the brain, the emotional part of the brain. So Francis McGlone thinks that this is, he likens it to the Higgs boson of the biological world, of the physiological world, you know, the God particle. He calls it the God neuron. He thinks neurons like this and others, as we work through them and understand them better, are going to prove why we are touch-starved, why there are significant issues to not being touched, to not touching. We're physical creatures. We're not unlike those gelada baboons that have been studied. You know, we're part of, we are definitely social creatures. Mm-hmm. So it's a really fascinating, and it was It's quite interesting. I asked a lot of the scientists and contributors when I first started talking to them, which sense would you least like to lose?
Great question.
Very few said touch. And yet by the end of that book, that's the sense I would least like to lose, having met someone who lost it.
Oh, okay, Jamie, which sense would you least like to lose?
Well, you know, when I had COVID, I lost my sense of smell for a while, and I was shocked at how much impact that had on me.
Yeah,
because you think maybe that would be one you could do without, but of course, it affects your taste and your ability to sense the environment around you. You just don't think about, you know, you can't tell if the house is on fire because you can't smell the smoke. So, having inventoried all my 5 or 6 senses.
Of which we have many more.
I'm sticking with all of them, I think. I'm just not ready to give up on anything.
Mm.
David, which one would you least like to lose?
Oh, touch. You know me. I'm a hugger. I'm a big hugger. It's definitely touch for me. Okay. But I wanted to ask, like, you made it clear in the book that we have so many more than 5 or 6 senses. Why do you think it's hard? It's been so hard to get that to stick with people.
It's well, yes, it's very sticky, that idea, isn't it? It's a bit of a philosophical question, this, you know, how do you define a sense? Do you define it by the sensor? Do you define it by the feeling? So I molded things, you know, for example, I split quite a few of the Aristotelian senses. So, for example, vision, I split into color vision and also dark vision, because we have the rods and we have the cones. So that was very simple. You know, I just used the sensor to break apart sight. And again, touch. I mean, we're just beginning to understand how these senses work. If you talk about just, you know, the Stoner's mold, topographical touch, there are many senses involved in how this glass feels to me as I kind of pick it up in my hand. The Nobel Prize this year went to scientists who are looking at pain sensors and temperature sensors. So we still don't know our bodies particularly well. You know, we are the last great frontier. I talk about skin, but it's... So as we get to understand our bodies better, we start to split apart these senses. And then there are the secret senses, you know, using Oliver Sacks's phrase, the ones that work beneath our conscious awareness, the ones that we only are aware of when they go wrong, our sense of balance, our sense of body and proprioception, and senses like that.
All right, do we know
any more about the hierarchy of intelligence of animals? I mean, we've learned a lot in recent years and decades about how much smarter animals are than maybe we thought, you know, a while back. Do we know any more about how to rate animals on the intelligence scale?
I mean, I think we've got to be careful with this word intelligence. For us, it's this human notion, and we've rated it as IQ. You know, we've just talked about going to college, getting college scores. But maybe a form of intelligence, you know, the octopus was one of my favorite chapters. Yeah. And the scientists there talk about embodied intelligence. Here's a creature whose body is working with its environment without even recourse to the central brain. So there are it's often these questions, these big questions come down to language. What do you mean by intelligence? I mean, if you're relying on who's going to catch that shrimp down in the deep, dark sea, I'd rather take the deep sea spookfish's chances over mine. So, you know, it depends what kind of intelligence you're talking about.
Well, you know, I'm thinking
it's such a human-centric notion.
So I'm thinking of solving problems, using tools, things that we associate with intelligence.
I mean,
empathy and being able to recognize... like elephants can recognize elephants from years ago, that sort of thing.
That whole section of science is fascinating. All those things are, we're studying them all the time. The octopus, again, it was a great example of intelligence. There was a wonderful story of it taking umbrage with a particular scientist.
Right.
That whenever that person would walk across the room, they would squirt water at it. this octopus was, but only target that particular person. And even if they took on their, put on their lab coat, they'd still recognize it. I think the more we study the creatures, these creatures, being more open-minded, we are finding these stories.
I think another, a wonderful next book for you, Jackie, would be on, and Jamie talks about intelligence. I increasingly, the older I get, the more I talk about how animals communicate. And just because yes. they don't communicate the way we do, doesn't mean they aren't, Jamie, I think, operating at a very high level. And they are capable of empathy. They are capable of resentment. They are capable of all sorts of emotions that we think are uniquely human. But I think it's fascinating. Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah. For a long time in science, people have been accused of anthropomorphizing animals, you know, Jane Goodall, when she was talking about. But I think science is having a bit of a groundswell moment to overturn that and be more open-minded. I mean, what struck me when I was writing this book was the endless similarities that I was, you know, being an evolutionary biologist, all the kind of senses, there was so much. We are made of the same stuff. And that was really, you know, apparent.
Yeah. Okay, Jackie, it's so late over there, but I have to read this. This is why we read to the end of books, people. It's wonderful. It's about the platypus, and you're thinking this is really cute and wonderful. And then you say, one of the things that comes through in this book is that we're learning so much about these creatures, and they are things that could help us learn about ourselves, could help if people have trouble with sight or with smell or these kinds of things. So how does it translate from these creatures to human beings? And the line that got me was this one. Skeptics may warn against tampering with our brains, but optimists hail the age of the augmented human. Augmented human, that is huge. How do you, as a scientist...
Huge. Thrown away in the last few sentences of the book. I mean, it's a whole new subject area, but there are people who are... our brain, topics that arises throughout the book is how neuroplastic our brain is. I mean, this is what David Eagleman has written a lot about, this, his wonderful book, Live Wired. And he's done quite a few of these experiments, actually, revealing how we can input different sensory information that our sense organs are not giving our brain, but we can input other ways of, from memory, Eagleman used a vest that vibrated in time with the stock market. And that, again, was being processed by the brain. So the brain is so neuroplastic, it can take all sorts of information that our sense organs at the moment are not giving it. And that's the other extraordinary fact in that last chapter, that our brain or our senses pick up a tiny proportion of what's out there. So this was a kind of sci-fi potential, who knows. I wanted to bring it back to the animals, because I think that by looking at nature, that's where we should be inspired, you know, really grafting and getting to understanding, you know, how a cheetah has exceptional balance, or how the octopus has an exceptional sense of body, or the star-nosed mole an exceptional sense of touch. If we can look at these creatures, they're going to teach us so much more about how to sense the world, whether we want to augment ourselves or not. I might leave that question to Mark Zuckerberg.
but do you want to augment us? Do you want to augment
us? I don't. I think that we are, I hope the message comes across that I think we hardly know ourselves as we are. So let's tap into what we've got.
I agree. All right. I'm not going to subject you to 60 seconds more, because you're too smart and too wonderful, and this book is too great. It's sent in. Jackie, what is next? What are you working on now? What's next?
On another project that hopefully will come out in the next year or so. And it's the same idea. It's taking a gnarly subject, like how we sense the world, and letting the animals explore it to better understand what it means for us. Nice. I don't know if I should say what it is yet.
No, don't. But come back, because we talk about all sorts of things on this show, books or not books, but come back.
I'd love to.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for staying up so late. Thank you for writing this fabulous book. Everyone should get it. It's fabulous.
Complete pleasure. Thank you so much. And everyone, lovely to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I wish we were in a room together.
Very nice
someday,
to meet you.
Someday. If you come to the East Coast of the United States, let us know. We'll find you.
I will. Maybe when the book comes out in softback later this year.
Oh, absolutely. We'll talk about it again. Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you, Tori. Thank you all.
Jamie and David, you guys stay with me. Okay. So 2 weeks in a row, we have had very smart people. And I just walk away from this going, oh, oh.
I'm such a dope. I'm such a dope.
So many references. So many. Well, of course, everybody knows the famous study of such and such. Sure. Oh, my God. Oh, but it really is. It is. I mean, I went to it for the animals. And then every one of the stories and how she would tie it together with the people who would spend months, if not years, teaching her how to catch something. And I think she's a really good writer because that could have gotten dense really quickly. And it was just so much fun to read. So much fun. Okay. I'm trying to think
when you learn more about these animals and how they function and how they work, does it give you any pause about eating some of them the way we do?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the more I think about it, the more I don't eat them.
Yeah. Absolutely.
The more I eat them, the more I don't think about it. I'm I have the opposite of the brain.
Just put it out of my ass is tasty. That's all I'm
gonna I can't think about it. And I will have a steak once a month, but that it's less and less and less.
I mean, I don't think I can eat an octopus anymore. They're too smart.
Have you seen the thing where the octopus I don't know if it's all of them. This was not in her book, so I wouldn't embarrass her by telling the story about the book. But there are these octopus that will change. They're like chameleons, and they'll change color depending on the terrain they're in, which makes sense. But they've now figured out that some of these octopi, change color when they're sleeping. So they think that is their dreams telling their brain or whatever.
Change
that,
color.
You're in this area. Yeah, which is incredible. Which is
crazy.
Yeah, they're absolutely amazing creatures. I've seen some really.
And they always pick the winner of the Super Bowl.
And they're escape artists, too.
Yes.
They escape more often than you would think from labs and aquariums because they're very, they can squeeze through places you wouldn't think.
That's right.
And they're very smart.
Got 1 minute. We are now done with this wonderful show until after Labor Day, but we have several people coming up after Labor Day. David Marinus, whose book on Jim Thorpe is getting just rave reviews. Anne Leary, who's got a great book out. A really wonderful young author named Latoya Watkins, who I think is going to be a hot shot, which will be great. But we're going to be off for a few weeks. So, David, good luck taking the oldest to school.
Thank you.
Again, I'll be 95 waiting to pick up the pieces if you need help. Jamie, stay healthy. Keep your hands off the stove, okay, my friend?
Will do.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay well, and we'll see you after Labor Day.